American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this.
The American people, I think, is good people. They have not to charge with the guilty of all the lies.
Welcome back to the Cold War Show. This is episode 199. With us today is author of, I think, over 1,000 books, looking at his biography, Michael Holtzman. We're here to talk about Michael's latest book, Spies and Traitors: Kim Philby, James Angleton, and the Friendship and Betrayal That Would Shape MI6, the CIA, and the Cold War. Welcome to our little show, Michael.
Thank you.
Was the 1,000 roughly right, give or take?
No, half a dozen of them.
Oh, like okay. That.
Does it feel like 1,000 or?
It's been kind of slow.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Well, listen, I love the preface of the book, and I just want to read a couple of excerpts to put people in the mood. We've talked about, obviously, Philby and Angleton and the Cambridge Five on the show before, but, you know, it's been some years, I think, since we did our little biography on those guys, so it's great to jump back into this, and it's kind of relevant where we are in our series talking about the Korean War, as we'll see. But in the preface of the book, you quote KGB spymaster Mikhail Lyubimov. He wrote, "The Cold War is over. It is time to discard its stupid stereotypes, which portrayed the people on one side of the barricade as schizophrenic homosexuals, alcoholics, chiselers, and scoundrels, and their opponents as pure saints committed to moral values." Then you write, "When James Angleton died in 1987 and Kim Philby died exactly a year later, the overarching historical narrative seemed firmly in place. In the nearly century-long struggle between communism and communism had lost, capitalism had won. Philby, with all his virtues, had chosen the wrong side. Angleton, for all his faults, had been on the right, the ultimately triumphant side. Things look less certain today. Capitalism has come close to collapse, and in its recovery looks less and less closely allied with democracy. And if the lands of the former Soviet Union are no longer ruled by the Communist Party, virtually all of the East Asian mainland is, shall we say, managed by Communist parties. Matters of historical interpretation have become increasingly complicated. That is a good thing. The old certainties created distortions, bending the interpretation of such information we have about the 20th century so severely as to be useful chiefly as information about the etiology of those certainties and interpretations themselves. We must now gather the used bricks of discredited historical narratives, chip off the mortar of early interpretations, and attempt to assemble what remains in ways less predetermined by the conflicting ideologies of their time. Of course, our stories no doubt will be determined by ideologies of our own time, of which we have little conscious awareness." Which is pretty much the best synopsis of this podcast we've been doing for the past 5 years, trying to piece together what really happened, leaving aside the mythology and the ideology of all sides. But I have to say, when we make comments like that, they tend to get us accused of being communists. So I have to ask, Michael Holtzman, are you now or have you ever been a communist?
Thank you. There isn't a Communist Party.
Mm. What about...
That's not a straight up answer. That's a bit of a dodgy answer. Are you pleading the fifth here, Michael? That's what it sounds like.
No, I'm just a matter of fact. You can't be a communist in the United States. There's no Communist Party.
Uh-huh. Mm. Okay. Okay. Maybe we should do something about that. Ray, would you like to?
Yeah. As when I was going through your book, as we've seen during the Cold War and even today in the U.S., it seems to be no middle ground. If you're anything other than if you're anything other than a conservative, maybe you're a socialist or you're a centrist or whatever, that doesn't seem to be good enough for a lot of people. The people on the right will immediately label you a communist, again, as if that's some kind of attack. So I just wanted to ask, in your opinion, are Americans still captive to that Cold War mentality of extremes?
It's a big country.
Yeah.
Some are. I think one of the Democratic Congress people was accused of being a communist the other day, which it's quite an accomplishment in the absence of the Communist Party.
Right.
Some aren't.
Is that just a bludgeon?
About 30% are
right.
Still fighting the Cold War.
Good point. Yeah, some of us are still stuck in the 80s, and I just don't mean our clothes and our hairstyle. But it still seems to be an attack that you have to somehow defend yourself from if someone does call you or label you a communist. So I don't know. It's still a rather effective tool to put someone in a corner where they suddenly feel like they have to defend themselves, as opposed to just saying, yeah, I care about the average person in my country.
Personally, I don't have it happen. I don't get out much.
Right. Good.
Yeah, like a podcast.
That's probably best.
Yeah.
I did want to ask, you've written about Philby and Angleton before, and so what prompted you to come out with this new book about them?
I found a lot more research resources.
Mm. Okay.
And I also wanted to reconsider what I had thought about Angleton.
Oh.
The JFK Assassination Committee persuaded the CIA to give them all the records pertaining to the Kennedy assassination.
Wow.
And I don't know how this happened, but it appears to me that they just backed up a dump truck to Langley,
right,
filled it with anything that was anywhere near the Kennedy assassination records, rotted up to Congress and dumped it on them. So you can go online and say JFK assassination records, and they're mm-hmm. more than 10,000 pages
wow.
Secret CIA records.
Mm-hmm.
And not all of them are about the Kennedy assassination, I'd say maybe the majority are, but they go back to the founding of the agency. And there's things like something, I think someone just published a book about this, there's quite a bit about the plot to assassinate Patrice Lumumba, including the contract for the killer and the contract for the gun.
Wow. Right.
So it's kind of that level of detail, and it's completely unorganized. You have to just start on page one and go to page 10,000, which you might want to do something. In that, there was a whole lot about Angleton. And I thought, well, that's interesting.
Right.
And then, you know, there's this Philby industry. So little bits come out that haven't been there before. And one can put together this avalanche of information about the CIA as an organization and the people in it, and specifically about Angleton, and the information that we have about Philby, and get a different look at what happened. So I did.
I have to ask, did you find anything amazing about the Kennedy? Did you come across anything about the Kennedy assassination? Or I find it, I guess the CIA was like, look, we had nothing to do with it. Here's everything we have. Maybe they felt safe in just dumping all these documents or making them accessible to the public.
Well, Angleton was the CIA's advisor to the Warren Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting the Warren Commission had a CIA advisor.
Right.
His job was to say that we didn't do it. Someone else did it.
Right. Okay.
And he did that pretty well. When he was advising these committees, you go on CNN, you go on C-SPAN, mm-hmm. and you see the meetings going on and the senators sitting up there on high and so forth. and they're diligently cross-examining witnesses. Right. Well, what you don't see is the previous day there was a meeting between the staffers of the committee, of the CIA, the FBI, and, working out what the script was going to be.
Oh, gotcha. So they knew ahead of time what was going to be asked, what was going to be answered. It's a lot like wrestling. It sounds like it was very staged.
Yes. And so that was Angleton's job there.
I guess he, like everyone else, did not like surprises. And so...
Oh, he did not like surprises.
Okay. Well, he may have got one with Philby. We'll get into that story. So let's start with Philby's upbringing, if we can. You know, there's sort of a running joke on our shows that in order to understand something, you often need to understand what came before it, what led to it. For example, before we started talking about the Cold War, we had to do like 25 episodes on the Yalta Conference because we felt that if you don't understand the Yalta Conference, it's very hard to understand what came after the Yalta Conference. And in your book, you seem to believe that in order to understand Philby and Angleton, you first have to understand who their fathers were.
On Yalta, did you read Elliot Roosevelt's book?
I couldn't get the book, but I got I read lots of quotes from the book in other places, yeah, which I'd love to read his book.
It's a real good source.
Yeah, I bet.
We'll have to go back and do another 25 episodes.
Yeah. Philby's father? Philby's father was perhaps a more significant figure than Philby himself in terms of world politics. Mm. He came out of that British imperial class from the Indian Empire. He was sent to school back in England. He did very well. He was a very good linguist, for example. And apparently a good horseback rider. That was part of the exam when you went into the India Civil Service.
Sure.
This is a few years before the First World War. Hmm. He went out to India and went up the civil service ladder, the British Imperial Indian Civil Service ladder. And the Brits had a few thousand civil servants who ran all of India.
Wow.
So they say, one to 10,000 ratio. Absurd ratio.
Right.
What you don't hear much about is that except in Kipling's novel Kim, is there was a very large secret intelligence service, secret police. Mm. And then there was a considerable army. But in any case, there was this very small civil service. And these young men were sent out after a rigorous examination in England, were sent out to India and made mayor of a large town or judge over a county.
Wow.
And then more and more responsibilities. So they had this huge amount of authority at a very young age. St. John Philby went up this ladder pretty quickly.
Right.
He was what they called headstrong. So sometimes they pushed him back down a couple of rungs, but then he went back up.
Right.
When the First World War started, the Brits wanted to take over the Ottoman Empire. So they sent an army up into Iraq, which was an important Ottoman province at that time, and conquered it after losing a couple of armies.
Mm.
At Kut, do you know about the Kut massacre? In any case, they conquered Iraq. And St. John Philby became the finance advisor, I believe it was, to the British puppet government of Iraq.
Mm.
And had a big house. He had gotten married by this time, and his wife liked his big house. Overlooking the river there in Iraq, Tigris, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It was doing very well, and then he got into a power struggle. They said, the imperial government said, why don't you go to Arabia and see what's going on there? Now, he went out to Arabia, and he became the British advisor to Ibn Saud, who was a chieftain. And Ibn Saud was trying to become king of Arabia. St. John Philby gave him advice and was his connection to the imperial government. As far as the British Empire is concerned, Arabia was a puppet of the Indian Empire, British Indian.
Right.
Another British advisor, this one to Hussein, who was another chieftain, was a military man in the British military intelligence, and he was T.E. Lawrence, who became Lawrence of Arabia.
Right.
So I had this kind of very nice researcher experience once. I was in the British archives in Kew in London, and I asked for St. John Philby's correspondence from this period. And they gave me this very big album, because it was the imperial correspondence, so they used big pieces of paper that were very thick. And it was not only St. John Philby's memoranda, it was T.E. Lawrence's memoranda as well. So you could see them writing to their superiors saying, my guy needs this, and if he gets this, then he'll be able to kill a lot of Turks.
Yeah. Mm.
So that's interesting, huh?
Proxy war, yeah.
And they knew each other too, right? And I found this...
They knew each other. Yeah, they knew each other.
I found a newspaper article... go ahead.
T.E. Lawrence gave St. John Philby a lift on his airplane at one point.
Even though they were supporting rival factions, as it were, but they seemed to be relatively friendly. And I found a newspaper article from 1941 actually calling Philby the modern Lawrence of Arabia. So that connection between the two was in the public consciousness, obviously, in those times as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and when Lawrence died, Philby was instrumental in getting a monument for him and so forth. Yeah. Some governments play both sides.
They win either way. Yeah.
They win either way. Right. So Philby became an Arab nationalist, like T.E. Lawrence did, and thought that the empire was doing the Arabs wrong. Mm. And he more and more moved from being the empire's man in the Arabian world to being the Arabian world's man to deal with the empire.
Right.
Eventually it went so far as he converted to Islam. Mm. And had a mansion in Jeddah. And as a retirement present, Ibn Saud gave him a slave girl for a second wife, as one would. But to go back, in the 20s and 30s, St. John Philby was as famous as Lawrence. Philby would go to Ibn Saud from time to time, and he said, he'd say, you know, no one's been in the empty quarter in Arabia in a long time. I want to go there. And Ibn Saud says, well, it's empty, you know, but here's a camel. So Philby would go off into the desert and look for ancient cities and make maps and so forth. And then he'd go back to London and write a book about it. There's four or five books about his explorations. And he'd go on lecture tours and things, say hi to his son and his first wife, and then go back to Arabia. And that was his career. It was very, very significant. If you go through the, as you seem to, if you go through the archives of the Times of London, every couple of years, there's a big story about St. John Philby.
Yeah, he was quite famous and well connected too. Something I learned from your book is that his distant cousin, later Field Marshal Montgomery, was the best man at his wedding.
Nice.
Yeah.
So well connected.
There was a period at the beginning of the Second World War where the British government thought that St. John Philby wasn't loyal, which is true, he wasn't loyal. that they imprisoned him. And then I think I must have quoted this. There was this big campaign among the ruling class to say, look, he's one of us. You can't do that. And they sprung him after all.
And you wrote that he advised Ibn Saud that Hitler would win the Second World War, recommended that the Sauds disinvest from Britain, and he helped broker a deal with the US to sell the oil interests to the US. So it seems like betraying Britain was a family hobby. It was the family business.
Yes.
Wow. Did he go? I guess he just went native. He went there, he fell in love with the place and went native. And
I guess that's the way I put it. Yeah.
Okay. Just, wow.
You write, too clever by half, too much given to seeing the native side of the issues, too often expressive of his own opinions, his career was constantly on the verge of being sidetracked. I don't know if you've ever seen David Simon's show The Wire, but for our audience, no, I'm a massive fan. And there's a character in that guy called McNulty, who's a cop who's always arguing with his superiors. He sounds like a McNulty kind of guy.
No, you don't do well. He eventually did well in his own terms. He had this mansion in Jeddah guarded by baboons and as much money as he ever wanted. And that he was so famous that whenever anybody came through, the area whom he might have been interested in, they were interested in him. So he had a good life that way.
Right. I have to ask, was he seen, or maybe he was seen as a traitor to his country by some segments, certainly maybe the government, but like you said, all of his other, for lack of a better word, elite friends were like, no, you can't do that to him. He's one of us. You can't, you know, he should be untouchable to a degree.
Well, if you want to open that can of worms, what is your country?
Oh, good
one. In Britain, before the First World War and until the Attlee administration, the ruling class, particularly the governing ruling class, didn't think of themselves as being the government of England or the government of the United Kingdom.
Right.
They were the government of the British Empire.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, Churchill's famous statement that he did not become the king's first minister in order to preside over the end of the British Empire. Right. That's what he was fighting the war about. He wasn't fighting the war on behalf of the United Kingdom, and certainly not on behalf of the 85 to 90% of the population who were unclean.
Right.
Yeah, getting back to Elliot Roosevelt, he tells some interesting stories about the Atlantic Charter meetings between his father and Churchill, where it's quite obvious that Churchill can feel the empire slipping away from him, and he's fighting, scrambling to try and keep it together, but he could just tell that he was in a terribly weak position. It's quite sad, actually, when you read some of the backwards and forwards between him and FDR, even at that relatively early stage.
I'm working on a book called The Anglo-American Cold War, which is about how the United States took over the British Empire.
Yeah.
And it's very clear from Elliot Roosevelt and from many other sources that Franklin Roosevelt had two primary war aims. One was to defeat the Nazis, and the other was to take over the British Empire.
I have to ask, did the Americans think they could just do it better, or here's an opportunity because they're weak? Why wouldn't we want worldwide influence and a lot more gold or riches or whatever? It was just an opportunity, I guess?
Roosevelt?
Yeah.
Roosevelt was an anti-colonialist.
Oh, he was just trying to deconstruct.
He wanted to take all of the empires down.
Oh, okay.
He was particularly horrified by the British Empire because he happened to run into it. Mm. But he wanted to get rid of the Dutch Empire in Indonesia and the French Empire.
Wow.
He was quite determined to do it. And towards the end of his life, he was the most powerful person in the world in a quite literal sense, not in a kind of de jure sense. In the fact
right.
So, and he was going to do that.
So Philby's father was a rock star. He was famous. He had traveled. He had created maps used by later generations, certainly in the war. So he comes from this amazing family that has a lot of money. And I imagine things are expected of Philby by his father.
Kim Philby.
Kim Philby, yes.
Expected. He was expected to be a member of that class. He was sent to the same private school that his father had gone to. And he was sent to Trinity College in Cambridge. This is a time when they weren't educating anybody. You know, that right into the 1970s, 2% of the population went through college in England.
Wow.
This is a great way to build up your intellectual capital.
Right.
So when Kim Philby went to Trinity College, he would have known everybody there. He would have known probably everybody in the university who he was interested in knowing.
Mm-hmm.
And that all of those people, all those men, were destined to be part of the ruling group.
And I guess they imagined it would just go on forever like that.
They thought they would go on forever.
Yeah.
So that's a bit about Philby's background. Angleton had quite a different background. He was the son of James Hugh Angleton, who you describe as a salesman and adventurer. Tell us a little bit about Angleton's dad and how you think he influenced his son.
Well, he very much dominated his son. Mm-hmm. James Hugh Angleton had a story that's very, very typical of that era for Americans that's been completely forgotten. Mm-hmm. The Angletons had lived in Virginia and then gone over the mountains to Kentucky. And that didn't work either. Then they went to Indiana, and that didn't work either. James Hugh Angleton was destined to being a rural school teacher.
Mm.
And the rest of his family were farmers in a place where you really shouldn't farm in Indiana. It's not a good place to be a farmer.
Right.
He decided that he'd rather not do that anyway, and he went to Boise, Indiana. Mm. Boise, Idaho, when it was one generation from the genocide of the indigenous people there.
Right.
The sorts of things that you do as a young man in a frontier area. He was selling candy. And then he got a job selling cash registers for the National Cash Register Company, which was the leading technology firm at the time. He was a terrific salesman. He sold cash registers to everybody who needed one in Idaho. Mm. And then he became a manager, and he taught other salesmen how to sell cash registers. He eventually was called back to Dayton, Ohio, where the headquarters was, and he was made a vice president for sales.
Nice.
About 1930, there were some economic problems, and the profits of the company were going down. He was sent out to Italy. He was sent to Europe to look at the branches of NCR in Europe and see what could be done to sell more cash registers. He looked around, and he came back, and he said, you know, I want to buy your operations in Italy.
Wow.
And they said, sure. So they sold it. So he became head of cash register business in Italy, based in Milan. He was president of the Italian-American Chamber of Commerce, and a very big thing, with connections all through the government of Italy at that time, the fascist government.
Right.
close to the American ambassador and so forth. It was a very, very big thing. Back in something that's quite interesting is that back when he was in Boise, before he became a success, he was in the National Guard, and he was sent with the Pershing expedition to find Poncho Villa down on the Mexican border. I think Idaho just tried to send the National Guard to the Mexican border again, but I don't know what Poncho Villa is doing. While he was down there, he met a young lady, Carmen Morales, who he thought was very attractive, and they got married. And their first child was James Jesus Angleton, the Jesus being from her family, and the James, of course, from his father. So James Angleton, our guy, was half Mexican, and clearly must have been had at least kitchen Spanish from a young age. He goes to Milan in his early teenage period. Learns Italian. Right? Not like Cinch and Philby, but he has his languages. And he's cosmopolitan. His father sends him to a private school in England. And when he graduates, he goes to Yale. So he arrives in Yale looking and acting like an Englishman.
Right.
So that's that background. The father continues to be a big fish in Italy until the beginning of the Second World War, when he enlists the American Army and becomes a major in OSS.
All right, let's skip too far ahead. Let's go back and talk about young Harold Adrian Russell Philby, a.k.a. Kim. Where did the nickname Kim come from?
Well, he was born in India, and people were reading Kipling. So they thought, oh, this is a great kid, you know, we'll call him Kim.
And then in his early teens, I read, I think it was in another book when we talked about him earlier, that he sort of spent some time with Bedouins in the desert to be turned into a man, a sort of coming of age thing. Did you read?
I've never heard of that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it wasn't in your book, but it was in my notes from somewhere else. But
Well, that is not true.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that explains it then. Yeah. Glad you clarified that. You write that while in Berlin in March of 1933, Kim Philby argued with a Nazi in a boarding house where he was staying with a friend of his called Mill. Philby claimed that Nazism was a reactionary attempt to preserve capitalism, which, in fact, I've argued on this podcast many times before, and in my last book, I talked about that quite a lot as well. And in fact, I would say that the capitalists were successful in using the Nazis to hold off socialism, at least in half of Germany. But I want to talk about why Kim became a communist. In your book, you quote him as saying, and I think this is from his book, My Private War. Is that what his autobiography was called? My Secret War. Thank you. Several factors influenced my decision, inner and external, emotional and rational. The study of Marxism and seeing the Depression in England, books and lectures and the rise of fascism in Germany. Fascism was one of the deciding factors for me. I was becoming convinced that only the communism movement could resist it. I'm going to talk a little bit about what you learned about Kim's reasons for embracing communism at a relatively early age.
Well, I think that sums it up.
He
looked around. He looked around England. I don't think he got to Scotland. He looked around England, and he saw that the government was waging economic warfare against most of the population. They kept cutting the welfare benefits. People who unemployed people were means tested, so that they couldn't have any possessions except their beds, and the miners particularly were slowly starving to death, and that this was a deliberate policy of the government, His Majesty's government in the United Kingdom, as they said. Did you have an episode on the general strike of 1923?
No.
Okay, so the miners were, after the First World War, the mine owners said, well, your good times are over, you know, we're going to stop paying you, we're going to give you longer hours, lower pay, and so forth. The miners went on strike.
Right.
And then the entire labor movement went on strike. It was a general strike.
Mm-hmm.
They lost. I think because of Ernest Bevin. In any case, they lost. And that broke the strength of the unions, and they got less and less money, and the working class, which was most people, got in worse and worse shape. And anyone who looked beyond the ivy-covered walls of Cambridge University to see this. So you say, all right, well, that's not good. And you're an idealistic young man. And then you go and you look in Europe and you see that exactly the same thing's going on.
Mm.
And then, as you just pointed out, the Nazi Party is coming to power in Germany. And it looked like the only group that was actually going to fight was the Communist Party. Mm. This was quite clear and vivid in Germany. Klaus Fuchs made his decision on that basis. He went from being a Socialist Party militant to being a Communist Party militant in Germany in 1933. Mm. Mm-hmm. You've surely done an episode on Klaus Fuchs.
No, it's a bit early in the timeline for us, but yeah, I think we've mentioned him briefly. We haven't gone into too much detail.
Very interesting, Matt.
Mm.
Anyway, so I guess the idea is that, like with Thoreau, you know, the question isn't why are you in jail, it's why are you outside, and the question was why these people became communists. The question is why others didn't. The specific instance, as you know, was that this fellow Deutsch, came up with this idea that the Comintern could recruit young members of the elite, and that all they had to do was wait, and that these young men of this very tiny group would rise up and become part of the controlling group in the British Empire.
Right.
And it worked.
It's a great, great long-term strategy. So Kim goes to Vienna, where he meets his future wife, Lizzie Friedman. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, she was a communist militant. So we're talking about Vienna in the early 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And things are even worse there. People are starving in the streets. The government is not just hostile to the working class. The government has declared war on them and is firing artillery shells into their apartment houses.
Jeez.
The Socialist Party collapses, and the Communist Party is fighting. So young Kim Philby was quite young, and given the mores of the English ruling class at that time was probably a virgin in terms of heterosexuality, gets swept off his feet by this young woman who is deeply committed to the revolution and is talented.
So they moved to London. Sorry.
There was a counter revolution in Vienna, and it became very unhealthy to be a committed communist in Vienna. And the only way that she was going to survive was if she became a British citizen. So he married her.
That worked out.
She became, it's called a British subject, not a citizen. So he married her, and they went back to London. And it was at that point that she said, I have this person you should meet, which was Deutsch. Mm. And Deutsch said to him, look, you're going to be a significant person in society, and don't you want to work for peace? And he said, of course I want to work for peace. Even Neville Chamberlain is working for peace. And Deutsch said, well, tell your friends that you're not a communist, that you've seen the light and you've become a fascist. Ooh. And then we'll wait and see. So he did that. And Deutsch represented the Comintern, mm-hmm. not the KGB.
Right.
So what Philby and his friends, Guy Burgess, Donald McLean, and Tony Blunt, thought that they were getting into was they were working for the Communist International, which happened to have particular strength in the Soviet Union, but was international.
Mm-hmm. So the Comintern was using the very rigid system of Britain against itself. If we can get some young 18-year-old guys who think like us, tell them to bide their time, because very few people are educated, because the same type of people keep taking over positions of power, this will work to our advantage. We just have to bide our time. That's incredibly impressive and patient for these communists to do that. And as we see it, it worked quite well for them.
Mm-hmm. You're sympathetic to these communists.
That's amazing. That is absolutely amazing.
Yeah. So they did that.
Yeah.
And they told Philby, tell all your friends that you've decided that fascism is best, and go for it. They didn't tell him everything to do. They just said, go that way.
Right.
So he joined the Anglo-German Fellowship. He did some writing for their paper. Then his father, through his connections, got him an interview with the Times of London. Mm. And they said, oh, you're a Philby. We'll hire you. And he became a stringer during the Spanish Civil War.
Wow.
On the side of the fascists, on Franco's side.
There's this, I mean, one of the fascinating things about his story, which you sort of articulate so well in the book, is throughout the course of the next few decades of his life, he is able to convince everyone that he believes this or he believes that. Sometimes he portrays himself as an ardent fascist. After the war, he's sort of an ardent British MI6 senior officer, working deep in the bowels of the CIA and the Pentagon, and he's closely connected with all the senior British politicians and diplomats and MI6 and MI5. Like, he obviously had an incredible talent to compartmentalize his real beliefs, his real thoughts. Like, with his father, it was pretty obvious where his sympathies lay. He was very open and wore it on his sleeve throughout the course of his life, and yet Kim obviously had this brilliant talent for deception. My last book was called The Psychopath Epidemic, where I talked about the whys and wherefores of psychopaths rising to power and sort of all of our organizations and the role that they play in society. What do you conclude about Philby from a psychological point of view? For most people to maintain a lie, not just one lie, but an entire fabric of lies, right, an entire persona for decades. What was it about him that enabled him to be so good at that, do you think?
I'm with you on that. I think he was a sociopath.
Mm. Right. Okay.
That was part of, sociopaths can be very charming people.
That's part of their defining characteristic, yeah. The successful ones, anyway.
And they just don't care anything about other people. It's very charming.
But he did care. That's why he became a communist, is he cared at the grander scale of things anyway. He cared, and there's evidence that he cared for some of his wives and those sorts of things. But, yeah, I don't know. It's I find it hard to sort of piece it together.
Well, his next, to support you on that, his next to last wife said, if you had to choose between me and the party, what would you choose? And he said, the party, of course. She left.
Well, yeah. Now, I want to quote the Times on the 1st of April, 1936. Someone was writing an article, and they wrote about his father, Mr. H. St. John Philby, denies that the great powers seek new homesteads. What they want is wealth, power, and the exploitation of the coloured man. So that was his father's view of the great powers. Do you think, Kim and his father had long late night conversations about the role of the great Western powers in the world? Were they on the same page, or were they from different sides of the street?
Okay, that's three questions. I don't think they had those conversations until they were both in Beirut. I just don't think that they were together enough.
Right. Which was decades later.
They had different motivations. Yeah, St. John Philby was acting out of resentment originally. Why don't you make me viceroy?
Oh, really? Wow.
And then gradually identified with the Arabs, like as T.E. Lawrence did, right? So I don't think that he was ideologically driven at the beginning. I think Kim Philby is obviously ideologically driven as a communist.
Or at least that's, you know, how he spun it or positioned it later in life.
No, I think that that's what it was. Did you see that video of Hobsbawm's life that came out earlier this year?
No.
Historian. It's a wonderful video. And, of course, that's what they always ask Hobsbawm. You know, why didn't you leave the party? Well, you make these decisions. You live by them.
So, as you say, in May of 1937, St. John uses his connections to help Kim get appointed as a special correspondent with Franco's forces in Spain for the Times. And you write, Kim Philby was accredited by the Times to Franco's headquarters, along with a recommendation from the German embassy in London, which described him as an ardent supporter of fascist ideas. Now, there's a job recommendation.
That's a really great job of recommendation. Yeah. So from that point on, there was a kind of apprentice period, and then from that point on, everything that the ruling class in England read about the Spanish Civil War that tracked what the fascist forces were doing was written by Kim Philby.
But the thing that blows my mind about this is the people in charge of the Times are going, oh, he's an ardent fascist. Great, that's the kind of man we want. Let's get him on the team. Send him out to Spain. This is 1937, couple of years before the war. You know, but it's just from a modern perspective, that's kind of outside of the Trump administration. That's a fascinating view and strange view to take.
Strange reaction.
The imperial ruling class was doing what it could to make sure that Franco won the war.
Why was that, do you think?
Because they didn't want the communists to win the war.
They were pro-Franco. Yeah. And he got a medal from Franco, didn't he, Kim?
He got a medal personally pinned on him.
Wow.
Worth its weight in gold, I would say.
Yeah. Wow. All right, so let's...
And then he goes...
Sorry, go.
Did you read any of the articles? They're very well written.
No, I didn't. No, just your some of your excerpts.
They're all anonymous, of course, but they say from our special correspondent with the nationalist forces.
And
he had a way with words.
What I gathered from your book, not only were they well written, but he was very convincing in his ability to portray the, you know, to write them from the perspective of an ardent supporter of fascism and Franco.
Mm-hmm. And mostly they're just factual.
Right.
He doesn't say, you know, the fascist swine then massacred all the women and children. He says that there was this movement of the regiments.
Yeah.
Right. Still.
So, skipping back to Jim, Kim and Jim. So, Jim Angleton, as you mentioned, went to Yale in 1937. And this, of course, is during the years of the Great Depression, the anti-communist radio rants of Father Coughlin, one of my favourite characters. We did a long series on Father Coughlin. The years of the Dust Bowl, the German-American Bund, the rise of Hoover's G-Men. Another one of my favourite characters, Harry Bridges, the Australian union leader who everyone hated and they tried to deport for decades.
Several times, yeah.
Capitalism... Yeah.
Another communist.
Yes, capitalism had failed in America as well as failing in the UK and around the world. I remember we were telling the story how FDR told Wall Street that he wasn't their enemy, he was their saviour, but they hated him anyway. Tell us about how poetry impacted on Angleton.
Angleton was a poet. He was a very good poet. Mm-hmm. Undergraduate poetry. I had some very good poetry. He also had his father's organizational ability. Mm-hmm. So he and a friend of his started this magazine, Furiosa, which is probably the best undergraduate magazine that's ever occurred, literary magazine. He published William Empson, E.E. Cummings, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound.
Pounds and pounds of Ezra poetry, Pound.
William Carlos Williams.
Right.
It had poems and essays and so on, and it was very good. And he became enamored of Ezra Pound. Mm. He spent some time visiting him when he was home between school years in Milan. He would go to Rapallo and visit Pound. He got so close to him that when the war started and the FBI was looking at fascists, they looked at him because they thought that he must have been a fascist. Fascist, since he was so close to Ezra Pound. The impact of the Depression on Yale is minimal. All those nice Gothic, neo-Gothic buildings at Yale were built during the Depression. Mm-hmm. And so once you were inside there, you were in the castle. Mm-hmm. You didn't see a lot of communists at Yale. It's not clear that Angleton paid any attention to anything except poetry and Ezra Pound's anti-Semitism, which he picked up.
Yeah, I did want to ask about that. I'm sorry, Cam. So Angleton's a big fan of Pound. Pound has right-leaning views, whatever you want to call it, certainly anti-Semitic. So I just want to clarify, Angleton's a big fan of his poetry, certainly picks up on his attitude towards Jews, which for Angleton will kind of change later. But would you say that's as far as it went? Did Angleton not, maybe because of Pound, keep going to the right, almost to the point of fascism? Or did it stop somewhere along the way? He was just being a good one percenter American, because his father was rather rich after a couple of years in Milan, I believe.
Yes, well, he was as rich as you need to be in Italy during the Depression.
Good point.
Angleton's politics were the politics of the American ruling class at the time. Mm. He probably was not as far right as E.E. Cummings, for example. Mm. And he certainly wasn't a fascist.
Okay.
I don't know whether you want to get into this. This is mostly in my previous book on Angleton. He married Cecily Dolchemont, mm-hmm. who was from Tucson, not from South Dakota.
Right.
And her Cecily Duchemin, who was a very good poet, and her mother were liberals.
Mm.
And a seriously wealthy family. The father, Mr. Duchemin, was a lawyer for the Duluth mining industry. Once they settled in Tucson, where they were the kind of dominant family in Tucson, the mother kept drifting to the left and took care of poor Mexican families in town,
right,
and that sort of thing. So that might have, we're just speculating, that might have stopped Angleton from going much further. His mother-in-law wouldn't have liked it.
Well, you quote a letter Angleton wrote to Ezra Pound in February 1940 where he says, "There is a hell of a lot of Rooseveltian and shilly-shally here in America." I don't know what shilly-shally is, but we'll get into that in a second. "Everything is definitely British, and the Jews cause a devil of a lot of stink. Here in New York will be the next great pogrom, and they do need about 1,000 ghettos in America. Jew, Jew, and Jew. Even the Irish are losing out." And we've pointed this out many times before. Anti-Semitism wasn't unique to the Nazis in the 30s and 40s. Anti-Semitism was the dominant mindset for 1,500, 1,700 years in Europe, and was the dominant mindset certainly of the elite and the upper class and many people in the working class too in the United States at the time. All sort of came to a bit of an abrupt halt after the war. But up until that time, you know, we've talked about the Evian conference many times on the show, when Hitler literally said, "If you want our Jews, we will pay to send them to you. Anyone who wants them, we will take them." And, you know, I always like to quote the Australian foreign minister at the time, who was ironically called Mr. White, said, and we had the White Australia policy in Australia at the time. He famously said at the Evian conference, "We don't have a racial problem in Australia and we don't intend to get one." Probably didn't talk to our indigenous population about that before he made that statement, but that was sort of the dominant view. The whole world during the Evian conference, pretty much, it's a couple of small exceptions, but pretty much the whole world, including the United States, went, "Oh, no, we're full. We can't take any. We can't take any Jews. Thank you very much for asking."
Roosevelt said, when he was a member of the board of Harvard, he was consulted about the fact that they had a problem that too many Jews were getting in. And he said, "Well, look, what we should do is have a quota."
Mm.
And so they instituted this quota system. I was doing some research on Norman Holmes Pearson at Yale. And for some reason, they let me look at the internal correspondence of the president and provost of Yale in the 40s. And one of them would write to the other when one of them had gone to have dinner with a wealthy Jewish donor to Yale, offering his sympathies. "Sorry you have to put up with that."
Right.
And for a while, Yale turned down the GI Bill, because if they had accepted that, they wouldn't be able to keep up the quotas.
Right.
Wow.
So then they felt they had to accept it, and they used the quotas in other ways. Angleton reversed after about 1944, mm-hmm. and became very pro-Israel. And we can talk about that. That's an interesting story.
Yeah, well, let's save that for a bit later on, because I want to talk about the connection with the OSS that you mentioned before. So you said that his father joined the OSS, was personally invited, I read in your book, to join the OSS by Wild Bill Donovan himself in 1941. Jim, the son, joined in 1943. So the Angletons had two family businesses, NCR Italy and the OSS. Meanwhile, you know, the
those are not very different.
Okay. And the Philby's family business was betraying the British. And around about this time, the father, St. John Philby, gets arrested by the British. Tell us that story.
The British consul, I think, in Jeddah, heard St. John Philby saying that the Brits were oppressing the Arabs and that it would be better if Britain lost the war.
Ooh.
So the next time St. John Philby went to London, St. John Philby said he wanted to do a lecture tour of America, pushing this point of view. And the Brits stopped him, got the ship, got him on another ship, got him to London, arrested him. And then it became a family quarrel. There was some part of the British police establishment wanted him to stay in jail, mm-hmm. and his wife, St. John Philby's wife, called up all her friends who happened to be cabinet ministers.
Wow.
You know, just by chance.
Sure.
And after some correspondence back and forth, they kind of did he's not going to hurt anything, is he? And they let him out.
If only Julian Assange was married to somebody who was friends with cabinet ministers, he might be out today.
The right people. Was it a gentleman's agreement? He can't hurt anybody, so we'll let him out because...
Yeah, it wasn't a judicial thing.
Mm. Gotcha.
It was an executive. Somebody wrote a letter.
Gotcha. Wow. The elite.
So Kim starts working for British intelligence around about this time, and this is the same guy the German embassy, the Nazis, described as an ardent supporter of fascist ideas. Then he ends up working for British intelligence.
Well, that wasn't disqualifying.
No.
Right.
How does that work?
What happens is that after he came back from Spain, he was sent out to France with the British Expeditionary Force and wrote all the articles about that for the Times. Mm. And that job kind of ran out in June 1940. And he went back to London again, and he was kind of at loose ends. And his father, he was recommended to someone high up in the British Secret Intelligence Service. Wow. And they said, well, we know your people. We'll hire you. That was the screening.
Right. That was the interview.
Yeah, right. Welcome to the club.
He was brought into MI6 specifically through SOE by Guy Burgess. Remember Guy Burgess?
Mm-hmm.
So Guy Burgess was doing propaganda for the Brits and in Section D. And that became part of SOE, the strategic group. And he said, I have this friend who's a good guy, and we should bring him in. He knows about propaganda. He's a journalist.
Right.
So they bring Philby in, and the organizations keep changing. And eventually he ends up in MI6, the International Secret Intelligence Service. Guy Burgess didn't kind of make that leap, because Guy Burgess was a bit ultra.
Right.
A bit difficult.
Yeah.
So he went to work for the BBC.
Yeah. Mm. Guy Burgess, obviously, one of the Cambridge Five, obviously working for the, was it the NKVD still at this stage, I guess?
He was working for the Commentary.
Right. So he brings Philby in to work for British intelligence. Now, so you've got, Philby now has access to all sorts of top secret information that he's passing on to Moscow. Tell us Philby's version of the Rudolf Hess story, because that's important, I feel, to understanding Stalin's view of Churchill and his alliance with the other members of the Big Three at this stage.
Well, Hess flew a plane into Scotland to work for peace. It's working for peace.
He's the good Nazi.
Sorry.
He wanted to meet with the Duke of Hamilton, who had been a member of the Anglo-German Fellowship that Phil Beek has been. And Churchill put him in isolation and wouldn't let anyone talk to him, which, you know, as you know, continued until Hess died. Right. And Stalin, who wasn't the most trusting man in the world, thought at this point that Hess had been sent over to do a deal, that there would be a reversal of alliances. But this is perfectly reasonable. Churchill was trying for a reversal of alliances since 1917, and continued to do so a couple of years later, in 44, a couple of years after his came over, he actually tried to do it. So it's reasonable for Stalin to be suspicious about this. And as a matter of fact, we don't know.
We still don't
know. The deal that is generally said was on the table, whether or not it was Hess but others, was that Germany would have Europe to the Urals and the British could keep their empire. Which, from what I said earlier, was probably a reasonably attractive offer for the British ruling class.
Right. Wow.
Not clear why they didn't do it.
Should have.
Well, Philby's version of events was that, if I recall correctly, was that Hess was claiming that he was sent by Hitler to do the deal. Hitler, of course, denied it publicly, and Churchill denied it publicly. But, you know, with Stalin's, you know, with the history between him and the British and the Americans and Hitler, as you say, he and we said this numerous times, he had every right to be paranoid. His country had been invaded twice in his life. The British and the Americans had invaded after World War One, trying to restore the monarchy. The, you know, the Germans obviously had invaded twice. The British were planning to invade.
The French were planning to invade the Soviet Union in 1939.
This is before or after the deal between Hitler and Stalin, the Molotov Pact?
Before. This was at the Finnish War, the Winter War.
Right.
They were going to try to help out.
And
they were within 2 days of helping out.
And if I remember correctly, Stalin agreed to the Molotov Pact because the strategic peace deal with the Nazis, because he believed that they were going to do that with the British. They were going to, it was like they were going to do a deal with the British and attack the Soviet Union. So it was whoever can get a deal with the Nazis first wins, basically, or avoids war for a couple of years anyway.
He needed some time to build up the army.
Yeah. But he was convinced that they were... Sorry, go.
We always read history backwards. The Soviet Union in 1939 was not the Soviet Union in 1950. It was a fairly weak, underdeveloped country that had a big army, but otherwise was not considered to be a match for Poland. Poland was about to invade.
Yeah, and there'd obviously been stoushes between the two for, well, you know, centuries, really. Okay, so Kim and Jim finally meet in 1944 when they're both in London. Jim's about 5 years younger than Kim, and Kim is a bit of a mentor to him, right? Teaching him the ways of spycraft.
Yeah. The United States had no secret intelligence organization until Donovan set it up, as you know. Actually, from here on out, all my statements should be followed by the phrase, as you know. OSS was set up. They didn't know how to do anything. James Angleton was sent to London to learn how to do something. He was sent to London to learn how to do counterintelligence. The star in British counterintelligence was Kim Philby. What you do in counterintelligence doesn't have much to do with a trench coat. You sit at a desk in an office and you read reports, and then you write reports. The National Archives of the United States in Maryland have cubic feet of reports back and forth from Angleton once he went to Spain, once he went to Italy. It's just an amazing amount of paperwork. Mm-hmm. So Philby taught Angleton how to do this, how you read this, how you keep in touch with people,
right,
and so forth. A crucial thing that happened was that the Brits were reading the German codes, as you know. And I think Philby himself developed a system where there would be these groups, a small group of people who working for British intelligence would be sent out into the field. And one of them would have been informed about the codes and that they had been broken. So this person would say, the Germans are going to have an offensive on Friday.
Right.
And they'd say, how do you know that? And he couldn't say, because we broke the German codes. He would make up something. He would say, oh, I just captured this German soldier coming across the lines, and he told me that, and I shot him.
Wow.
And this became something that Angleton got very good at. Anyway, they're back in London, and Philby's teaching him all this stuff, and Philby becomes the British counterintelligence person for the Western Mediterranean. Mm. And had as his great coup a project where they got all of the German Avar agents in Spain expelled.
Wow.
So after that was a good thing. They gave him a medal. Yeah. Wow. And he got a lot of prestige. So he had taught Angleton what he needed to know. Angleton was still writing poetry, apparently. So they send Angleton out to Italy about the time of as the Amalfi invasion. That wasn't it. It was the next place down the coast. So the United States had the lower half of Italy. The United States and Britain had the lower half of Italy. And Angleton became head of counterintelligence in that area. He did a really good job. And as the armies went north, he became head of counterintelligence for all of Italy.
And the head of NCR for all of Italy at the same time. So two jobs.
Quasi-head of?
NCR.
National.
He's like the junior vice president or something of NCR at the same time.
Yeah. So all this time when he had a technical problem or he needed some special information, he'd call up Kim, I need some help with this.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wow.
And that went on until the end of the war, when, as you know, Truman dissolved the OSS, and the people who were in OSS were trying to save it. Donovan was trying to save it, and people in the various other units. So the people who were in the counterintelligence unit were trying to save it. And they went up to London, and they asked Philby for his advice on how to do this.
It's great.
So they were tight.
Yeah, very tight. It's a great story. So going back a bit, in 1944, Philby told Moscow that he'd heard the USA and the UK were collaborating together on creating this thing called an atomic bomb, and they just apparently forgot to tell their staunch ally about it. How do you think Stalin would have interpreted that news at the time?
He would have been very disappointed and lost his trust in the United States and Britain.
Which he didn't have a great deal of to start with, but yeah. I think he trusted FDR to a degree. They seem to have a genuine sort of simpatico going on.
Yeah, FDR wanted to tell the Soviets about the atomic bomb.
Who prevented him from doing that?
Churchill.
How could Churchill prevent FDR from doing what he wanted? FDR was definitely the senior partner in that relationship.
The Quebec Agreement and the Hyde Park Agreement said that neither the United States nor Britain would tell any third party about the atomic bomb without the permission of the other.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So Stalin knows what he's dealing with. Yeah.
Yeah. Stalin knows he's being, well, they're hiding this from him, obviously.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody Stalin had lunch with was telling him about the atomic bomb.
Right. Wow. The world's worst kept secret.
Donald McLean was on the Combined Policy Committee
mm-hmm.
in Washington that made the decisions about the financing of the atomic bomb.
Right.
So it's all getting back to Stalin.
Yeah. So Philby eventually gets made overall controller of MI6's secret agents in the Soviet Union, which is just so hilarious. It's hard to believe this is a real story.
He was in charge of the anti-Soviet activities of the MI6, yeah.
Wow. That's incredible.
And he accepted the job with a straight face.
Yeah, who better to be in charge?
That's true.
It's just, it's so astounding. Right, sorry, yeah.
So he knew then everything that was being done by the Brits and the Americans to weaken the Soviet Union, to roll back the system.
So all those years ago, I'm sorry, his handler, or whatever the proper term is, told Philby, pretend to be on the right, lay low, that is paying huge dividends for Soviet Russia right now. Because, like you said, they got access to the British and American intelligence activities, so that is incredible. I did want to ask this question before we move on. As a World War II buff, because I found this amazing. I knew some of it, but I didn't know a lot of it that I learned in your book. Could you tell me about Plan Ivy and Prince Borghese? And that Donovan, I would assume, is trying to take credit for ending the war, at least in Italy, which is kind of ironic because, like Cam said just a minute ago, the OSS is not going to be long for this world. But could you tell us some about that and how it helps bring the war to an end, at least in Italy?
You're talking about Dulles.
Dulles, is that who I'm talking? Okay, but if you could tell us about Plan Ivy. And Prince
Borghese is an interesting story.
Mm-hmm.
One thing you do if you're in charge of counterintelligence is you try to turn other people.
Right.
Say, you know, you don't want to work for those guys, that losers, come work for us.
Right.
So a very important Italian military person was this Prince Borghese. And Angleton wanted him so that he could control over Borghese's group.
Right.
On the other hand, the Italian partisans wanted him too, so that they could kill him. So there's this very dramatic thing that I narrate there, where Angleton, probably for the only time in his life, gets his service revolver and his chums, and they go up to where Borghese is hanging out, and the partisans are at the front door. And Angleton says, I'm Angleton, here's my badge. And they let him go into the apartment house, and Angleton gets Borghese, and they go out the back door. Which would make a great scene in a movie, I think.
Right. That's pretty courageous for him.
It was very courageous, and out of character. That seemed to be a completely unique thing.
Mm-hmm.
He was probably pretty happy and pretty excited about that time. Angleton got control over the Italian naval intelligence system.
Wow.
This way, by turning people. And then, it's not clear, but maybe the entire military intelligence system of Italy.
Philby taught him well.
Philby taught him. And through that, they then had sources in the Italian cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
So members of the Italian cabinet in the mid and late 40s were CIA agents.
Wow.
he was also interested, and from this point on for the rest of his life, in developing liaison relations with other intelligence agencies. Mm-hmm. So he established very good relations with the Brits, of course, but also with all the Allied agencies that were present in Italy, and of course everybody was, because who wouldn't want to go to Italy? Right. And also the Vatican's intelligence agency, which was very good. He also established relations with the people who later put together Mossad.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I have this information, I'll take that from you, you take that from me, we'll give this to the French. Right. And develop these networks. At that point, as I said earlier, he liked them. Right. And the anti-Semitism just kind of goes away.
Right.
And later life, he would vacation in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another story that I'm sure you want to get to about that. So Philby has picked out, he does such a good job doing anti-Soviet work for the British Foreign Intelligence that they say, before you can become head of MI6, they don't actually say it that way, but, you need to get some experience in the field. So he first went to Istanbul, and then he went to Washington.
Which, of course, puts him in the perfect position to spy on both countries for the Soviets. This is part one. Next time we'll see you with part two, where Kim Philby and James Angleton get together, become friends, and then there's betrayal.
An iron curtain has descended across the continent.